welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're here giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m. streaming live at those times at richarddugan.com, and also the podcasts, which are at SoundCloud, iTunes, TuneIn Radio, Stitcher, Spotify, as well as Blueberry and Player FM and a bunch of other sites that folks are linking us to, and we thank you for that. That's kind of cool. And also want to let you know that we are also wanting to encourage you to go to the website, to go to the podcasts, click on the little grocery cart. It will take you to our guest's website, which we will be giving you in just a couple of moments. So we want you to stay right where you are in that regard. We'll give that to you shortly. And also, go to our missions page. If this is maybe the first time you've listened to one of our podcasts, one of our programs, you can go to the missions page on richarddugan.com to read as well as hear what we're all about. And if you'd like to support us financially, for which we are eternally grateful, I am serious about that, we have a PayPal and Patreon account so that there's some security there. If you'd like to help us out, thank you, thank you, thank you for those who have and those who will support the program. We are going to dive in to an interesting subject, I think, today. I think you're going to enjoy our conversation today with our guest. He's a native New Orleans gentleman who is going to share with us a lot of very interesting information, not only from A Brush with Death from the Art of Death series, but a whole lot of other stuff. His name is Jody Summers. And Jody, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Richard.
Now,
glad to be here.
Pardon me. I'm all choked up over all this. Now, you've got this series. How many books thus far in this particular series called Art of the Dead series?
Oh, I've got three books so far. Got a couple other plots in mind, but I kind of ventured out into some other genres after the first three.
And I'm just curious as to the desire you had for this particular genre. These, would you put them under the category of mysteries, horror, chillers, dramas? Where would we put these? Because you've written some other stuff too.
I would call these supernatural thrillers. There's a pretty good line of romance going through them too. But I found out that if I called them a supernatural romance, a lot of the people that like romance don't like supernatural, and vice versa. So I was shooting myself in the foot.
Well, I can certainly understand that. It's really interesting, though, that the whole aspect of the supernatural realm, if you will, is it's not something that we've really focused on this particular program. But I know that obviously we do talk about our spiritual lives, that immortal part of who we are as human beings. Before we go off into other areas, tell us a little bit about your desire. What is it that drove you to create this particular series? And because obviously it's of interest to you, this whole aspect of the supernatural.
Well, the process that got me here was kind of interesting. I used to write poetry when I was a kid, probably have written it most of my life, but it never crossed my mind to write a novel. About 10, 12 years ago, I found myself out in Los Angeles with some time to kill and contacted a lady I'd been speaking to on the phone and asked if she had a chance to meet me for a drink because I'd never met her in person. And turns out this lady was doing these paintings with the ashes of the deceased. And she calls the ashes of the deceased cremains, is the term. And I was so taken by the concept, I read profusely.
Jody, before we continue, I'm hearing a thumping sound every so often.
Oh, sorry about that.
That's all right. Go ahead and continue. You were talking with this gal.
Yes, and she does these paintings with the ashes of the deceased. And I have read so many books in my life, and I realized I had never read anything on this topic. And I've always been a bit interested in the supernatural anyway, and it struck me that it would be really cool to write something new under the sun. So I began writing and found out I had a knack for it and have just stayed with it.
And obviously it interests you. Have you a background, if you will? Give us a little background on your upbringing in terms of I like to refer to it as the philosophy, if you will, that you were raised with.
My parents brought me up in the Methodist Church, and I was always, I guess when I was young, I was kind of an agnostic, and have kind of gravitated away from that as I got older. And now I refer to myself as a Christian, but not very religious. But I have always had a bent towards the supernatural. I've always been fascinated with haunted house stories, and I've actually stumbled across a couple in my life. And anything in the supernatural had always been something that interested me and something that I read a lot of.
Interesting. Well, I know that I'm not a real big horror film, trauma drama kind of guy. I guess I have enough in my life, which I don't have a lot, but be that as it may, it's sufficient for me that I don't need to see other people's, and especially a lot of the movies that come out that are just so stereotypical. You know, the girl is usually the first one to die, and there's always screaming, and it's like, oh, come on, I can't. And I have to tell you what really turned me off was when my wife and I went to see the that one movie that came out called The Blair Witch Project.
Oh, yeah.
Now, when I first watched it, I thought, wow, unbelievable. Then when the truth came out, I was ticked. I was so mad. And I'm going, are you kidding me? You took us. Now, granted, every movie that's ever been made, with the exception of documentaries, it's a fictional story most of the time, right? So why should I be so bent out of shape that they created this fictional scenario? But it was because of, obviously, they made it out to be, they tried to portray it as being real, in that respect. Needless to say, none too happy about that. But standpoint.
I don't know that my book, I struggle with that. When you're trying to market your books, they kind of try to pigeonhole you into certain genres, if you will, and one of the ones that tends to be in front of me is horror, and I don't know that I think of my book as a horror. It's not your chopped up blood and guts, for certain. My main character, Kira, in the series does these paintings with the ashes of the deceased as a means of creating a tribute for the loved ones. And it just so happens that she begins to have visions and images from the subjects of her work. So there she is, much to her surprise, there she is doing this painting, and all of a sudden she's having dreams and images of aspects of the personality or the life of the person she's painting.
Now, you know as well as I do that around the country, if not around the world, when people are cremated, there have been generated new companies, new businesses, new models doing just that, for helping the those who are left behind, you and I, to have some kind of a memorial. We did that, for example, about a year ago when we released my dog from her poor ailing body. We took some paint and put it on her paws, and then pressed it onto a mat board. And we did this with white on black and black on white. And then one of her friends, my wife's friends, took one of those, and she made this leather heart with the imprint of my dog's paw into the leather, so she actually carved it in or what have you. And so I have that hanging in my truck off the rearview mirror as a way of memorializing her, because we laid her to rest in the ground. But there are companies now that will take the ashes of your loved one and compress them and put them into like jewelry, like a ring or a pendant that one can wear, and so to speak, have that person with them all the time. this to me seems like something that's really happening. Are there people, have you found anybody that actually does that?
Oh, yes. The girl that I met out in Los Angeles, this was actually her new vocation. She was doing this and has been doing it for years, creating tribute paintings with the ashes of the deceased.
That is really very cool. Honestly, it really is. Now, are you familiar with her process in terms of, does she get a photograph from them, or does she just take the ashes and she mixes them into whatever the solution is to make the quote unquote paint, and then it's more intuitive and creative and imaginative and off the cuff, so to speak?
I really never got too much into her process with her. In my novel, that's the way it works. She mixes the paints with the ashes of the deceased, mm-hmm. and receives some kind of an image. Usually she gets some kind of an idea for the topic of the painting, because it's not usually a portrait. It's a scene of some form.
Right.
She gets an idea for that when she mixes the paint. As far as the ladies that was actually doing this, as far as her process, I never quizzed her too much on it. I was kind of, at the time, I was kind of just taken aback. It was a new concept for me, and I just kind of thought about it a while.
Right. What about your perspective on the supernatural? On, as I mentioned before, you and I would both tend to agree that the true essence of who we are is immortal. And I don't even know what it is. All I know is that there's this some kind of a force that animates this physical body, that animates your body, that animates the bodies of all of the people that we come in contact with. And when that leaves, for whatever reason, the body ceases to function. And it's like, okay, well, what the heck is that? And I remember a documentary where they were actually doing some testing to try to figure out where that would reside in the body. Well, they couldn't really identify it, but they did determine that there was something, and it actually had physical weight to it, because they would weigh the person right before their passing. This was, of course, all with their permission and everything. And then they would weigh the person right after their passing, and there was a slight decrease in the weight. I mean, we're talking ounces, but there was a diminished mass to that person. And it's like, well, wow, then that essence, for whatever reason, has a substance to it. You know, it has a material, or at least it manifests in that fashion. What about your own perspective? Because when you go into these supernatural stories, such as A Brush with Death, as we're talking, and again, I find the general premise of it fascinating as all get out. I just think that's so cool, and I would love to be able to do that with loved ones. You could, again, because they're with you forever in that respect. But your perspective on maybe from your Christian perspective, but just maybe from you and your personal perspective, how do you see our existence and our immortal? Our immortal lives, if you will.
That's kind of a heavy question. First off, let me say that the study you're referring to, I believe I've read that same study about weighing them and the difference between before and after.
Mm-hmm.
I do believe that we, you know, have a soul or a spirit, as however you'd like to refer to it. And as a matter of fact, one of the arguments that I thought was fairly compelling is I read something years ago about, I guess it was the conservation of energy. And so if, you know, when you die, your body decays and goes, that energy goes back into plants and dirt and nature. But your thoughts, the energy that produces your thoughts is kind of an electrical energy, and it goes somewhere as well. Where does it go? And that was one of the things that kind of started wheeling me away from agnosticism and getting me back towards Christian faith is my basis.
Mm. I have to say that agnosticism to me is the most honest of all the philosophies, because again, this is just from my perspective. I'd love for you to comment on it as well. From my perspective, there is no evidence in this material world of an afterlife. I mean, you know, again, we can read about it in so many of the ancient wisdom teachings. We hear about it from people who've had near-death and out-of-body experiences. But those are their experiences. It's when someone passes away, Jody, I sit there going, what are they doing now? What are they experiencing? What's happening? You know, I would like to tag along just for a little while and then come back. You know, I'm not ready to go, okay? although, if today were my day and the expiration date on my ticket was today, I'm good to go. There's a lot I still want to do in this life, but you know what? If this is it, if this is my time, okay, let's do it. Let's get this going and so forth. But what about your thoughts in that regard? And I'll just leave you with this and let you comment. I always heard it, a wonderful saying that I was given when I was 21, because I was rather, brash, I suppose you might say. And someone said to me, it is better to begin in doubt and end in certainty than it is to begin in certainty and end in doubt.
I like that. I have found myself repeatedly in my life, and I don't know how I got here, but I found myself attempting to visualize what the instant of my death might be like, what it's going to feel like at that particular moment. And I guess it's left me more than just a little intrigued with near-death experiences. I've read several of those books as well. But it's like trying to imagine the air, you know. It's something you can't really put your finger on. And I guess that's where we get into faith. You know, you've got to either, I had a really good friend that we used to have a few glasses of wine and start discussing religion, and he's an atheist. And I keep telling everybody he's my very favorite atheist. But he just really believes that that's it. There, you know, your body dies and that's it. And I never have been able to subscribe to that. And it also feels like in my life I've experienced connections with other people that you can't explain through, you know, the physical either. I like to tell everybody that when cell phones first came out, I've got a lot of friends around the country, and when cell phones first came out, I had a propensity to pick up the phone the minute I thought of one of my friends and call them, and just because. And as a result of that experience, I've found out, I would say about 85% of the time, they pick up the phone and say, man, I was just thinking of you. And it to me spoke of a connection that's beyond something you can see, smell, feel, touch, or taste. And it helped strengthen my, you know, belief in an afterlife, something else. And almost, I've had moments in my life where it almost left me wanting to be a little bit in a hurry to get there, because maybe that's a cooler adventure than this one.
Well, take your time.
Sanity took over somewhere shortly after that.
Well, you know, it's funny too, because if you wanted to, let's just say right now, you, Jody Summers, said, you know, Richard, I got to go into another room right now. Okay. And I might be back. I don't know, but I'm just going to go. Matter of fact, I'm going to walk through the door that's behind me with the number 3 on it. Now, our listeners can't see this, obviously, but there's a door behind you with a number 3 on it. And I'm going to walk through that door and I'm going to close this door. And that's what I'm going to do. And I'll say, okay, sure. No problem. But if you were to say to me, you know, Richard, I've done everything I want to do in this life, and I want to move on to the next one. If there is a next one, I want to get started, and I want to go. And most people would say, hey, Jody, no. Maybe you should seek some therapy. Maybe, you know, everything's okay. You're not alone, and it's all, everything's good, and we'll get you some counseling. And it's like we can't, you know, our society has told us that if we want to leave this world, there's something wrong with that. And I find that really interesting, that I can buy a new car and I can move to a new place and I can get a new wife and I can get a new job and I can do all of those things as long as I stay here. But the moment I say I'm done, I'm good to go, I want to leave, all hell breaks loose, so to speak.
Well, I think when you say you want to stay here or don't want to stay here, if you're using the comparison of something like door number 3, everybody in their mind has a picture of what's behind door number 3. It's a room. It's, you know, there's something else in there. But the door number three you're referring to, if you're talking about leaving life, is something nobody can imagine. And that's probably what scares them as much as anything. And even if you're a staunch, let's say, Christian, and you're absolutely certain you know what's behind door number three, it's the little print you can't see that says heaven, or not. It's a little more scary unless you feel like you've got some kind of certainty. And the only certainty you get is faith, really.
Yeah.
There is no proof for the spirit. And I think that's the purpose of having faith. I was writing about that in one of my other novels.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about that, but you actually, and again, our listeners can't see this, but behind you is a door with a three on it. Would you mind explaining that?
I'm on an oil and gas project out in West Texas right now, this is a place I'm staying. It's an Airbnb.
Oh, okay. All right. So this is someone else's home. Okay.
Yes.
But I find that rather synchronistic. You know what I'm saying? Isn't that interesting? And, of course, a lot of people may not get the reference to door number three. You'd have to go back to Monty Hall and Let's Make a Deal. And what's behind door number one? What's that?
I was wondering if you were going to say that.
Oh, yeah. Hey, I remember I used to watch it all the time as a kid. Loved watching that show. I want to get into another area also, because you've written, obviously, you have several books in this series thus far in your work. As you said, you've got another one you're working on now. But you also have another book called The Mayan Legacy. And it's in the same genre, is it not?
It's probably more of a science fiction. It begins with a guy having a near-death experience, which I've got a good story about that, and he sees his life pass before him, but he sees something else besides his life passing before him, and sometime later he realizes there's an asteroid coming and he needs to see what he saw again to possibly save the world. And so he starts trying to have near-death experiences intentionally to reproduce what he'd seen. And it was interesting. I racked my brain for weeks trying to come up with a near-death experience to use in the beginning of the book. And then I thought, well, you idiot, I have my own that would suffice just well for the first chapter of the book. And I don't know if you can see it on the camera, but I have a little scar here that goes all the way around my neck.
Yeah.
I actually got yanked out of a boat by another boat with a parachute line wrapped around my neck and drug underwater for 100 yards. And I had like three different ways to be dead in 30 seconds, and somehow I wasn't. So that's described in detail in the first chapter of my fiction.
Well, now I have a friend who had had a heart attack in a restaurant, and he was lucky enough that there was actually a doctor in the restaurant at the time, but he was actually clinically dead for a period of time, but remembers nothing, has no memory whatsoever. What about you? What do you recall of that experience between the time that you were yanked off the boat and you regained consciousness?
You know, that's interesting because obviously I've thought about it a lot, and it's pretty much a blank. Just before I left the boat, I took a deep breath because I knew I was going under the water, and I did actually have on a life vest. It was my small accommodation to safety. And I took a deep breath and was determined I wasn't going to breathe in Lake Houston at the time. And I got snapped over the bow so fast, the guy driving the back boat, I had one boat pulling another boat doing this. He said if he had blinked, he wouldn't have seen me leave. And I have no recollection of that parachute line dropping around my neck. I have no recollection of it burning. But when I came to the surface, I must have removed the rope from around my neck. But I don't have any recollection of that even. The first thing I remember is that my neck burned and I was dog paddling back to the back boat. And when I got to the back boat, my girlfriend at the time screamed and fainted because I had this, it cauterized, that parachute line cauterized that went in, and I kind of had a bunch of melted skin running down my neck. Oh. And this bright white line where it cauterized. Mm. And, you know, for the life of me, not only do I not remember any experiences in between, I don't remember the physical experiences I actually did. You know, how to get that rope off my neck.
Yeah, speaking of a brush with death, let me tell you, that's I have not had anything like that happen to me. I have not had those kinds of experiences. As a matter of fact, my mother asked me once if I could share with her any spiritual or supernatural experiences that I have had. And I could not. I told her, I said, if I've had them, I didn't look at them that way. You know, one of the things you said, too, about your atheist friend who doesn't believe that there's anything after this, you know, that if there is nothing after this, we're not going to know it anyway, right? Because there's nothing after this. but I'd still like to hold out hope that that there will be, that there is something. I'm going to take a break here, and we're going to come back because I want to talk more about the Mayan legacy as well as your series, Art of the Dead series and A Brush with Death. Jody Summers is my guest. Jody Summers Books is the website. JodySummersBooks.com is the website. We encourage you to go to that website to find out more about Jody as well as about the other books that he's got in the series. And we encourage you to do that. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. You know what? We'll be right back.
Stories, I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're here with the author of A Brush with Death. Yes, indeed, ladies and gentlemen. We are only a hair's breadth away from the beyond, whatever that might be. This particular book is in a series called Art of the Dead. Art of the Dead series. How'd you come up with the name of the series? Because I'm assuming that the other titles, the other books that you're going to be titling, are probably going to have some reference to art, if you will.
Well, as a matter of fact, they do.
How did I know that?
The second book in the series is called A Brush with Fire, and the third is called A Brush with Evil.
Ah, so you're sticking with that motif.
we kind of thought the brush thing was, you know, tricky.
Yeah, well, I think that it's very cool. You know, when one can, whether it's my genre or not, whether I enjoy that particular genre or not, it's irrelevant. There are people that love it; they really enjoy it, and I hope that they will find something there for themselves that helps them out there. I wanted to talk about your one of your other books. Again, it's the Mayan Legacy. And I found it fascinating as we approached 2012, December 21st, 2012. I will share with you what my wife said about the Mayan calendar. She said that she felt that it wasn't the end of the calendar, but the guy that was chiseling it out with the little hammer and chisel got to a point where he said, I've had enough. I'm done. Tossed the hammer and chisel aside and walked away. And that's the reason why the Mayan calendar ended, because he just had enough.
Well, you know, I did a bunch of research on the Mayan calendar before writing the book. Not that I used all that much of the research in the book, but I thought it was interesting that the Mayan calendar kind of depicted some celestial event supposedly out a couple thousand years in the future, and how the heck they could do that accurately when they weren't familiar with leap year just kind of amazes me. You know, it's like they would have been a month or two off. In my book, there is something that actually happens at the end of the Mayan calendar. It just happens way the heck out in space. And it's what redirects an asteroid towards Earth, and that event happened at the end of the Mayan calendar. So
oh, wow.
Something happened. We just didn't know it yet.
Yeah. Well, and of course, then what we do is we make a few phone calls, and we call Bruce Willis, and we call Tommy Lee Jones, and might even call Tom Hanks, and get them together, and we put together a shuttle with a laser beam in the cargo bay, and we go after this asteroid to destroy it, and they'll save the world, and you have yourself a new movie.
you go. Pick a version, right?
Pick a version, any version. But when you were doing your research on the Mayan calendar, and I'm curious, was this before December 21st, 2012?
No, it was after.
After. Okay, so this was after the fact. And I love the way it's written that, you know, the way it's on your website, which, by the way, folks, is JodySummersBooks.com, that it talks about how 2012 came and went and nothing happened. Or did it? Which is, of course, what you've alluded to. And I would tell people, think back to the year 2000, January 1st, 1999 to 2000, as well as 2000 to 2001, because there was the argument that the new millennium didn't start until 2001. I mean, there was this debate that went on because we started with, you know, I don't know if they didn't have zero. There is no year zero, allegedly. But it's like, well, you know, you have to have some transition somewhere. You know, you could go from negative one to positive one. Anyway, and I said, think about Y2K. Now, unfortunately, I got sucked in and I spent $29.95 on a piece of software and I installed it. And then I got to thinking about it. And then someone told me that they had heard about a conversation between some people who were asking this woman back in the 50s. She was very high up in the computer industry then, which was, again, it's pretty great, but it's never, you know, I never heard about this. And she was even asked, so what are we going to do at the end of the century, you know, going from 1900 to 2000? And she says, nothing. Nothing's going to happen. It's just the clock is just going to roll over in the computer. It's not a big deal. And that's exactly what happened. Nothing. And I remember gassing up. It was a Friday. It was actually a Friday. The 31st of December was a Friday where I always gassed up my little Metro on a Friday. And it usually go 2 weeks and so forth. And I was there paying my bill. And this woman comes in frantic that I got to get my gas car. I got to get my car fueled up because, you know, it's coming and you know, we've only got 12 more hours. I think it was around noon or 1 o'clock. And I told a woman, I said, look, and I was working for a station that was monitoring, starting with Australia and working around the planet, and nothing was happening. And I said, you need to calm down. Nothing is going to happen. Everything is fine. You can just relax. You can fuel your car up. That's fine. But you need to calm down. And she did a little bit. And of course, 2012 came and went and nothing happened, which was so fascinating. I'm sorry, Y2K came and went and nothing happened. So I basically was telling people on this program as we approached it, because this program started in 2007, you people need to relax. And if anything does happen, it's going to be of an internal process. Kind of like, you remember the harmonic convergence of the 80s? There was an event that took place celestially that was referred to as the harmonic convergence, and it was supposed to help us to raise our consciousness and those kinds of things. Very, very new age. And I don't recall anything really happening. But as you began to research the Mayan calendar, I'm curious as to how far, how much in depth did you have? What did you learn in regards to some of the meaning behind some of the information that was contained? Because, I mean, there are hundreds of books about the Mayan calendar and its meaning, even before we hit 2012.
Well, first off, I'd like to point out that something did happen in 2000. That party that Prince had must have been huge, because he was, you know, partying like it was 1999. and I didn't get an invite, and I wished I had. But the research I did really was focused more on what was supposed to happen, and it's a I describe it in my book, but to try to go ahead and verbalize it, it's kind of a complex celestial juxtaposition of things going on, and it took me about a chapter to explain it in the book, and I hope I did it well enough that people left it feeling less confused than I did when I read Michael Crichton's foray into quantum physics in the book Timeline. I was like, what? But it's just got to do with it's just got to do with a celestial alignment. So it wasn't so much a spiritual thing of any sort that I saw.
If you're just joining us, we are talking with the author of A Brush with Death, and it's in the Art of the Dead series. Jody Summers is my guest. JodySummersBooks.com is the website. Evil comes alive when she paints with ashes of the dead, which again we talked about in the first segment, that it's really something that people are having done, among other things. I think it's actually kind of cool in one sense. Some people think it might be a little macabre, but to each his own. I mean, that's just kind of the way that it is. Going back to the Mayan calendar, going back to that whole genre, if you will, and again, there were a lot of people that were really, I mean, there were people, there was one woman that I contacted who had written a book about it and was generating a lot of fear. She just was going off on what a catastrophe this was. We better prepare, get your bunker ready, or all these kinds of things, right? I chose not to interview her because I wasn't wanting to go down that road. I did not want to go down that rabbit hole. What, in your perspective, from your personal experiences, do you recall what happened in your life, or what do you recall experiencing around that time?
The things that stand out in my mind are just center around the computers and what kind of the ramifications of what would happen if the computers in the world all shut down because they couldn't roll over to 2000. I guess I was skeptic all along as far as anything actually happening. But the theories were interesting.
Yeah. Well, and of course, again, I had installed that software to help the computer to supposedly click over. But before that happened, I uninstalled it because I continued to do research. I felt badly because I had supported somebody's $1 million bank account, you know, but found out that nothing was going to go haywire. You know, that's not to say that things didn't happen. I hear you. But at the same time, the whole scare was just very interesting. I know that a lot of people put a lot of credence into some of these things. As a matter of fact, something that came to my mind along the lines of the Mayan calendar, I was thinking of even the, for example, the predictions of one guy who a lot of people know, a rather famous individual in history, Nostradamus. Have you ever done any research into him?
I did. I can't tell you too much of what I learned, but I do remember doing some research on Nostradamus and also some other prophets we're discussing end times and things around the end of the Mayan calendar.
Yeah. And what are your thoughts about some of these quote unquote prophetic things in the world? And again, just to give you a quick point of reference, I worked for 15 years for a Christian radio station. So I am quite versed in much of what has been taught and what's been promoted over the decades. And so I'm curious as to your personal thoughts from your position or your place of faith in reference to some of these kinds of utterances that come out of these different sources, whether they be Nostradamus, the Mayan calendar, which, you know, obviously that goes back even further, or even some of the people today who just they seem like they have this connection. I mean, you talked about this earlier. You experienced this aspect of connection, for example, when cell phones came in and you started saying, I'm going to make some calls. And they said, hey, I was just thinking about you. What about that connectivity in terms of people talking about the future in that regard? Do you put much credence into that?
Into prophecy in general?
In general, yes, in general.
I guess the only prophecy that I put a lot of stock in is biblical.
Okay.
And that leaves you with plenty to wonder about, that's for sure.
Yeah. And yet there are some of those prophetic utterances, say, of Nostradamus, based upon, quite honestly, based upon how you interpret them, is as to whether or not those actually happened. I mean, there are people who have taken his writings and they've laid them over particular historical events. I mean, there are those who say that he predicted 9/11, for example, what happened on September 11th, 2001. Among other things. And it's like, okay, I can't argue. I don't know. I just don't know. Do you think that we get caught up too much in wanting to know what the future is? That we forget about living in the present moment?
I believe that if we knew the future, we would be a lot less happy. Everybody thinks they want to know the future. And it's the age-old question of, so if you could push a button and make the choice to know when you were going to die, would you like to do that? You know, how many movies have been made about that?
Yeah.
Everybody thinks they want to know until they know. And then they really wish they didn't know. I read a study somewhere that was talking about, choices. And they said that actually having more choices, they've done this study and proven that having more choices makes people less happy. You know, if you've got a choice between, I want to buy one of these paintings, and there's three paintings, and I like them all, and I've got to pick one. When I buy the painting that I decide I want, I have second thoughts about maybe that other one was better. Whereas if somebody told me this is the best painting, this is the one you want, and I'd buy it, all of a sudden I'm so happy because I didn't have a choice. I know I got the best painting.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I have a book that's called Choices, 5 Steps for Life. And I use this analogy. I don't know if you've ever been to a restaurant called the Cheesecake Factory. We have one out here in Glendale, California. You ever been to one? Or are you familiar with them?
I am familiar with them. I haven't been to one, at least not in recent memory.
Well, if you ever go to one anywhere near you, you're going to notice the magnitude of the menu. I mean, it's almost like a phone book. All right? I mean, page after page after page. You know, and I'm sitting here going, all right, this is great, but I don't even know where to start. Yeah, bring me one of everything, please. You know, and they'll be filling every single table in the place with food. Because there's just the plethora of choices. You just don't know what to choose because it all sounds so good. But you've got to make a choice, you know? Or... Right. Just no, I'm just going to read the menu. That's filling me up, you know, kind of thing.
Oh, I think maybe it's a plot. I think those places that have huge menus like that do that, so you'd have to have two or three drinks.
Yeah.
Before you decide what you want.
we do talk about this whole aspect of choices and knowledge of those choices, but that's the other aspect of it. You know, you talk about whether you have one painting or three. Well, what if you didn't know you had the other two? And, of course, you only had the one choice. I guess then the choice is, do I buy it or do I know? Do I don't buy it? Do I not buy it? Whereas if you have the three, it says, which one do I buy or not buy? You know, but at least then you have the option. And so we talk about that a lot on this program and how important that is. You have what? One or two other manuscripts that you're working on?
I have another book that I need to do a rewrite on. I've done the first draft on it, and it's a Christian thriller called The Note from Christ. And it's about an atheist archaeologist Jew whose life is a mess. He is on the Talpiot dig in Jerusalem. I don't know if you remember the Talpiot dig. It was the one where they were saying they'd found Joseph's tomb. Therefore, Mike could prove, you know, they found Christ's bones or something, or that they might find Christ's bones. And anyway, this guy goes for a walk one afternoon in a funk and ends up in the garden tomb and finds a handwritten note from Christ to him with his name on it and the date that he found it on the letter and 10 signs to prove the veracity of the note. And that's where it goes from there.
Oh, that's pretty cool. I like that. That's pretty neat. I talk about a personal relationship, huh?
Yeah, right.
How does he know me from Adam?
Right. Good. That was a good joke there.
But I kind of like those stories. They're fascinating because it raises those kinds of questions that help us to learn more about ourselves. I remember back in the 80s when an author by the name of Kazantzakis, his book, The Last Temptation of Christ was made into a movie. And I remember the brouhaha that the station I was working for at the time made over it, and we were running commercials telling people to boycott and so on and so forth. I have to tell you, the more that went on, and the more people complained and moaned and groaned about all of the different issues, the curiouser and curiouser I got. So I got a copy of the book, and I read through most of it, but what really was profound to me was the preface. And in the preface, Kazantzakis says, and I paraphrase, "These are just my musings. What if? I'm not saying this is true. I'm just, and it was a work of fiction." And yet here you are, you're writing a work of fiction, and I'm wondering, you know, how much blowback you're going to get. Oh, no, Jesus never wrote any, as far as we know, we have no record of him ever writing anything. How could you go down this road? I mean, these would be the staunch, you might say orthodox individuals who would say, no, you got to stick with what's in the book. And not in your book, the book, okay, the Bible.
Right.
And I find that so sad that, quite honestly, when people have that freedom to go down those kinds of roads like you're doing with that. And again, I applaud you. I think that's kind of a neat premise. I really do. It's very intriguing. We start asking questions of ourselves. You know, why do I? And there's a Christian musician by the name of John Fisher. And I had a chance to interview him back then. And we got to talking. He was living in New England at the time. He had moved out of L.A. and California back to New England to a place that was off the beaten path. He grew up in the Jesus movement of the 60s and 70s. And I thought it was so fascinating when he started talking about how he started questioning what he believed. Now, not in terms of his faith, per se, but in terms of, is what I believe what I believe, or what they told me to believe in the Jesus movement and so forth. And that's one of the things I want. What about you? Is what you believe what you've chosen or what you've been told by others? These are the things you need to believe in, you know, in order to be right with God.
My faith was hard won. Like I said, I started off being agnostic as far back as I can recall. Even though I was being drugged to church every Sunday. And not sure I'm that big of a believer in church these days anyway, for a variety of reasons. But I started questioning, and the faith that I ended up with was pieced together from a variety of choices, if you will, made about different circumstances. I've read a book about the case for Christ, and I've read another book about the mathematics of the Bible, and to me there's ample evidence to prove the faith that I have. And it didn't come from just the Bible. It came from examinations of the information in the Bible and examinations that other people had made. So I guess the short answer would be, I think I came to it myself.
Well, and quite honestly, that's the most honest way of doing it, from what I understand, is to come to it by yourself or for yourself, from the standpoint that it's your relationship, right? It's your and I heard this phrase over and over again. You have a personal relationship with God, whether you God the Father, God Christ, Jesus, or what have you, or the Holy Spirit. And I always found it fascinating when I was there, because I was challenged quite vigorously over my salvation, because I was always asking questions that were rather, I think you could say, heretical, okay, that I probably would have been strung up back during the Spanish Inquisition for asking these questions. But I thought, well, wait a minute. How is it that you're challenging my salvation? I thought it was my personal relationship with the Almighty. Not yours, as far as judging me. I always found that so perplexing.
I will say one thing. If you come to your faith the way I did, it's awful hard to shake it, because it wasn't what somebody told me. It was what I came to believe after. I read a story years ago. I was much surprised. I guess J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis were good friends. And Tolkien was the one that drugged C.S. Lewis kicking and screaming to Christianity. And it wasn't until C.S. Lewis had researched it rather extensively himself that he came to agree with his good friend Tolkien.
Hmm. Well, and to me, that sounds to me like he was a really good example. I would assume that he probably didn't preach to the guy. He didn't, you know, beat him over the head with the Bible saying, no, you have to believe this. He just lived his life.
Right. And maybe his conversations with his friends set C.S. Lewis on the path.
But. Yeah. I mean, we don't know. But I think that's, to me, that's the way that you bring people to the understanding of the philosophy under which you live is, and the faith that you live in, is by your life, by living your life, you know? And not going after them and badgering them and so forth.
That was, you know, I'm not much of a evangelist. I don't do that well. But by Note from Christ novel, I did have a purpose in that. I was kind of hoping, at the very least, to help doubters doubt their doubts.
There you go.
It was kind of what I was trying to do with that. And that's as far as I figured I need to take it. I figured God can do the rest after that.
There you go. There you go. I find it fascinating, Jody, that I've always loved this when I've had the opportunity to interview those who are professing Christians, but who have their own mind. They aren't repeating the party lines, if you will, the talking points, if you will, that we hear all the time, that they have come to their faith, as you have, on your own terms, so to speak, okay? Because you're asking the questions. You know, and you're allowing certain experiences to happen. And I just, I applaud people regardless of where they are. And again, it's like I said before, I find the agnostic philosophy to be the most honest because I remember when I used to work for a station where we were running Larry King from the Mutual Broadcasting Network back in the 80s. And he's an agnostic, or at least he was, as far as I know, he still is. He says, I don't know. And that's the most honest answer I can give you. I don't know. And when you start from there, then to me, it seems to me that you have an opportunity to learn something.
Well, if you, in so many different texts, they try to use science to prove the existence of God. Or
yeah.
They say you can't, or to disprove.
Disprove, and, yeah.
What strikes me as interesting about that is science is to do with the physical world. You don't measure non-physical things with science. And so that I've kind of used the premise in my book, A Note from Christ, that faith is the proof for the Spirit. And the reason we're not supposed to know, quote unquote, is because then we wouldn't have to have faith. And that's what builds your spirit, not some scientific proof.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you said that you were, where are you right now again?
In Odessa, Texas.
Okay, and you work for the oil industry, is that right?
Yes.
And you go out on do you ever go out on the rigs?
No, I avoid them like the plague. I actually am in the exploration side. I basically wander around out in the country where I'm mostly lost. And talk to people I've never met and try to explain something they don't understand and get a permit out of it.
That sounds like Christianity or other faiths.
A microcosm.
There you go. There you go. Well, you know, the reason I was curious is because you have to have some level of faith if you're out on one of those rigs. Because you're out there with maybe a bunch of other guys, but you're still out there in the middle of the ocean or, in your area there, the Gulf, which is still huge. Okay. You wonder if anybody's going to come to get you off of this thing because there's not much room to walk around. I mean, obviously there is plenty, but still, you know, it's like you're rather isolated and I'm sure that it must get a little claustrophobic even on those big oil rigs. In the derricks and so forth. We have them out here in the Santa Barbara Harbor, in the channel, here off of Santa Barbara. And I look out there sometimes. They refer to them as the crystal ships because at night the lights come on and that's what they kind of look like off in the distance. And I think, God, you know, when there were people on board those things, I always wondered how they're not that far from the coast on the one hand, because we can see them and they can see the coastline, sure. But still, you know, it's not like something you're going to swim. Although I was rather impressed. What did you think of that woman who swam the English Channel four times? In a row.
I missed that bit of knowledge. I was on with a friend of mine who did a swim from the shore in San Francisco out to Alcatraz.
Oh my gosh.
Apparently there was a bunch of them that did it. It was an event.
Cuz swimming the other way, you know, from Alcatraz back to the coast. I can't remember if they ever said if anybody ever escaped Alcatraz.
I think there was one or two that did.
Yeah. Of course, they don't know if they survived the swim, but wow, that's still a long, a pretty good distance there.
Right.
How does the work that you do if I'm correct, oil exploration, how does that tie in? Have you seen a corollary between that and the writing that you're doing, or vice versa?
You know, I've had a lot of people tell me that with the experiences that I've had doing this permitting job, that I ought to write a book about that. And they did do a movie that was in the field that I'm in. I forget the name of it. It was just the last few years ago about a guy that was permitting and different fables or myths you get about what it's doing or what it's not doing to the land.
Mm-hmm.
But I've never really, I'm so entrenched in this, directly, that I've never really been motivated to write about it. My books, if there's one thread that runs through my books and will continue to run through my books, is my plots are unique and twisty. If they're not, they bore me and I can't write them. So whether I'm switching from genre to genre or not, all the plots I write are very twisty. And although I've got quite a few interesting stories from what I do day to day, I've never been motivated to write about it. Though, from a Christian point of view, I do feel like I'm doing a little bit of that 40 days and 40 nights in the desert. Out here in Odessa, it's like pump jacks or cactus.
Now, are you actually looking for places to put wells, to drill for oil, or are you doing something other than that?
The exploration that is most predominantly done for oil on, well, they do it over water too, but it's mostly on land,
mm-hmm.
Is called seismic. And a seismic survey is basically a gigantic sonogram, just like a baby.
Oh.
Except the baby's oil and gas. And they vibrate the ground with big trucks and have receivers that sit on the ground that receive those echoes. And it gives them a 3D image of the oil deposit. That's how they can now do horizontal drilling, because you can't horizontal drill if you don't have this information.
Right. Now, you would horizontally drill if you didn't have access to the land directly above that supply, correct?
No, it's usually the reason I'm laughing is because you touched on the crux of what I end up having to explain to some landowners quite frequently.
Mm.
That just because they own the surface doesn't mean that they control what goes on underneath it if they don't own the minerals.
Ah.
The mineral owner has precedence over the surface owner. So if the mineral owner wants to go on the surface owner's property, they have the right to do so, whether the surface owner wants them to or not.
Ah, okay.
The reason they do the horizontal drilling is because not every deposit is large from top to bottom. Some of them are large from left to right, or east to west, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And to get the maximum out of those, you've got to go horizontal through it instead of like, you know, punching a hole in a piece of paper rather than punching a tunnel along the width of the piece of paper.
Right, right. Now, I've also understood, and correct me if I'm wrong, because I'm trying to learn here too, that when they do pump the oil or the gas, obviously there's a cavity there that has these are either the gas or the crude oil in that cavity. And so the liquid in particular, the petroleum, if you will, is maintaining the pressure on that on the earth around it. And if you were just to remove it, then there's the potential that that cavity could collapse, and obviously you would then create more problems above. So they replace the petroleum or whatever they remove with some other substance like water, so that the pressure is maintained under the surface?
I had asked a geologist that same question when I was trying to permit him, and he was giving me a hard time as a joke. and he said, no, when you pump the oil out, it doesn't leave a hole. Something will fill in there, and it usually is water, as far as I understand.
So it's a naturally occurring event, so to speak. It's not that they pump it in. It's that it comes from somewhere.
Yes.
Okay.
The only time they pump the water in is when they're, you've heard the term fracking.
Yes.
Fracking is hydraulic fracturing.
Yeah.
And they pump in water under high pressure to crack shale to let it release the gas or oil that they're trying to collect.
Yeah. There was a friend of mine several years ago, and his theory seemed to make sense because I thought that we have been extracting billions and billions of barrels of this substance out of the earth, and we're still doing that, and it doesn't seem like there's any end in sight. And his theory, this was his theory, mind you, that these deposits of, and again, I'm speaking specifically of the liquid petroleum, okay, the crude oil. He says these deposits were not from the dinosaurs. These weren't from the decaying, that's the general theory that most of us lay people have been told, okay? Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But he says that's not what it is. There are these trillions and trillions, obviously even more than that, googillions of these microbes. And they eat whatever it is that they eat. And this liquid is their excrement. And so there is a never-ending supply of this substance because these microbes are under the earth and they continue their existence and they're consuming and excreting. And so the supply of crude is never going to end as long as these microbes live. Now, how much it seemed theoretically to make a lot of sense to me because, again, we've been pulling, I don't know how many trillions of barrels out of the ground for what? Since what? The late 1800s?
Something like that.
You know, over 100 years. Come on, the supply. If it was from the dinosaurs, as again I was told, we're going to run out because there was a finite number of dinosaurs.
Right. Or the vegetation that was growing at the time of the dinosaurs.
Right. So, I mean, again, go ahead.
I've heard the same story and have no clue either.
Yeah. It's interesting to theorize, I have to say. It really is. And, of course, I know that the oil industry is under a lot of pressure because people want sustainable forms of energy that aren't polluting the air and so forth. And I know that new methods of, say, combustion engines, not just electric cars, but combustion engines that are cleaner and cleaner and cleaner. I mean, look at California, L.A. My God, you can see across the city line. You couldn't see across the city line in the 60s and 70s. So obviously some changes have been made, and I think that's a wonderful thing from that standpoint. But by the same token, I don't know that I'd want to air condition my home with the exhaust from my truck.
Nice.
Not a good idea. But nonetheless, I don't want to go down this road too much further, but I do appreciate your sharing with us because I don't think that a lot of people really understand. And I that's part of this process that we do on this program, as you hear in the lyrics of the song that opens the program, that we're just trying to, we just want to understand. I'm not saying I agree, whether we're talking about your faith, whether we're talking about death and dying, whether we're talking about the oil industry. I just want to understand so that I have a point of reference of at least a better, more informed point of reference. I was listening to a story on NPR where this woman had gone to this protest because she felt that, you know, the side she was on was correct and the other side was incorrect. And as she began to dive into the story, she found out that the position that she had taken was the wrong position, because the information that had been released through the media, through social media and so forth, was incomplete. The whole story hadn't been told. So she actually wrote an editorial apologizing for being taken down that road because she didn't have all the information. And I find that that's the case we've got a lot of in this country, especially today, but around the world for that matter. We just don't know what's going on, do we?
Well, one of the things that I like to repeat over the years is that truth is a lot harder to find than people seem to think it is. I mean, when I was a kid, wasn't Pluto a planet? I mean,
yeah.
Where did it go?
Yeah.
Well, and one year they'll tell you you can't eat this and you got to eat that. And the next year they'll tell you that that will kill you if you go, so you should go back to this. I'm like, well, okay.
Yeah.
Where's the truth?
Well, that's today. Today, coffee's bad for you, but tomorrow it'll be okay. But then the next day it'll be bad for you. And the same thing with Italian food and avocados. And all, and it's like, quite honestly, that's when you have to exercise your faith and belief in a higher power that will keep you safe, that will guide you to the right foods and beverages and this and that and the other. And that's where we have to begin the trust in that respect. And I really appreciate your sharing with us here today, Jody Summers. And the book is called A Brush with Death, Art of the Dead Series. And I do look forward to this other book that you have coming out, A Note from Christ. I think that's a neat premise.
Thank you very much.
I also want to let our listeners know that if you'd like to get more information, go to jodysummersbooks.com. That's JodySummersBooks.com. Again, A Brush with Death, and it's in the Art of the Art of Dead series. And we encourage you to check that out and obviously listen to the entire podcast, because there's a whole lot more we talked about. And certainly thank you so much, Jody. And should you ever find yourself out here in California and here on the West Coast, hey, wouldn't be a bad idea to continue talking more about this. I do have to say, too, that I find it fascinating that they decided, and I don't really take a side on this whole oil thing, but I do know this, that here, I don't know if you're familiar with our channel, but we have oil seepage. But it's just from the natural pressure from the oil that's under the ground, out in the channel. And so they put those oil derricks out there to pump out the oil that reduced the seepage. Well, of course, the environmentalists are saying, no, we don't want this because of the potential of what happened in 69. And it's like, okay, then guess what? You're going to have a lot of oil on the beaches. You can't escape it because that pressure will build once again. So, again, it goes back to the whole aspect of how much information do you have and are you working with, and are you willing to accept? And again, at least understand, you don't have to believe it, you don't have to change sides, but at least have an understanding of what's going on. And again, we thank you for helping us to bring that forth.
Thank you, Richard. It's nice talking to you.
I have three final questions, if I may ask you, before we go.
Sure.
First question is, who is Jody Summers?
It is I.
That is probably the best one I've heard in 13 years. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
Richard, I, much to my astonishment, when I started writing A Brush with Death, which was originally called titled Dark Canvas, I found that I love writing. I have done just about everything you can think of under the sun, from having a patent in the pet product industry to selling computer chips. But when I started writing, I realized I'd found something I love. So it would be nice to make a good living off of it, and that would be my retirement. So that's kind of my point. I just love writing these stories.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
I think that would, I could repeat the previous answer. pretty much hit that too.
Well, Jody Summers, again, I thank you so much for sharing with us about the work that you're doing, both in the oil industry, but also in your writing career. And we thank you so much for sharing all of that you've shared with us here, as well as A Brush with Death. Again, JodySummersBooks.com is the website, and we really appreciate the time.
Thank you very much, Richard.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.